Stand, please. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Jonathan Jacobson of Wilson Sonsini for Mylan, and arguing today on behalf of all the appellants. With the court's permission, I'd like to start with the violation issues and then move on to damages.
You may want to speak to jurisdiction somewhere along the way.
Well, we filed our papers. I believe the papers lay out our position.
We have your papers on all the issues, counsel.
Yes, Judge Sentell.
What do you want us to do about the jurisdictional issue?
Well, I think there are two alternatives. First, and what we believe is the correct alternative, is to conclude that given the text of Rule 17A3, diversity jurisdiction was lacking from the outset as a result of the ratification process used below. As a result, not only did no supplemental jurisdiction attach, but original jurisdiction did not attach, Judge Williams, and therefore the appropriate disposition is to vacate and remand for lack of jurisdiction. The alternative is to hold that the ratification process fails and that the 1,400 additional plaintiffs should not be included in the case. And we know that, one, 3M destroys diversity jurisdiction. What we don't know, because we don't know the identities of these other plaintiffs, is, you know, what state's law applies. These are state law indirect purchaser cases. Many state laws don't recognize indirect purchaser cases. Many states follow the federal system and do not allow these cases to begin with. So, you know, we think the whole Rule 17 ratification process was flawed. So if the court does not vacate and order dismissal of the entire case for lack of jurisdiction, at a minimum, we believe that the ratification process should be thrown out and the recovery limited to the named plaintiffs in the case.
Another alternatives are usually one or the other. So there's another option. And the third option is to remand it and instruct the district court to determine if there are any parties that are any of the self-funded that destroy diversity jurisdiction, and if so, it exercises authority under Rule 21 to dismiss them.
Your Honor, that is an alternative. Mm-hmm. It is one that we suggest is eminently inappropriate in this case. The Eighth Circuit case that we cited to Your Honors suggests a completely different result, which is the result that I'm urging, dismissal of the case, or at least elimination of the improper plaintiffs. But here
Rule 21,
why not that?
Yeah, Rule 21 relates back to the original complaint, right? I mean, it's a relation back. So that whatever action is taken to eliminate a party that destroys diversity jurisdiction relates back to the time of the filing of the complaint, in which event all the proceedings would still be valid, the trial, the rulings of the judge, and so on.
Well, this Rule 17A rather than Rule 21, Judge Randolph, but let me...
Newman Green say it relates back? I think it did.
Rule 17A3 says the case proceeds as if the ratifying plaintiffs were in the case to begin with.
No, I'm not talking about ratification. I'm talking about Rule 21.
Rule 21.
But the parties, if I could have the rules, the parties here did not proceed under Rule 21.
Yet.
That's true. Now, let me add another point. There are 1,400 of these people. We asked for their names. They were not provided to us.
Did you make a formal discovery request? Or when you say you asked for their names, what's the context of that? Was that in jurisdictional discovery or what?
It was not at the outset of the case. It was later on when the ratification process was raised. The record sites are laid out actually in a footnote in the appellee's brief, Your Honor. If you give me a moment, I will give you the specific references.
No, but again, when you say you asked for them, did you do that through a formal discovery request? Was there a motion? Was this just a telephone conversation? Was there a letter? What?
Your Honor, I believe that there was a discovery request in connection with the Rule 17 process. I believe it was in writing. And I'm looking for, if you just bear with me a moment, the record references. The citation in Appellee's brief is in footnote 9 on page 50. It's not in the joint appendix. It's to the item 894 on the district court docket, the April 27, 2005 transcript of the telephone conference.
So that's the best you've got is the transcript of a telephone conference when you make the statements that you tried to find out the identity of these parties and were refused?
I believe that...
That's all you get to go
on? Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I believe there was a request made in writing. I do not believe it is in the record on appeal. It is not disputed on appeal. The request was made, that a request was refused, and the case proceeded, adding the 1,400, notwithstanding the non-identification of those names. And my point is that for the very same reason one would deny class certification in a case like this, because of all the individual issues with 1,400 claimants, that a remand for what amounts to the same process is not an appropriate disposition.
I'm not sure why it's not appropriate.
Yeah.
I mean, in other words, huge resources have been spent on having this trial, and the results are salvageable by removing non-diverse parties. Why not do it?
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, that is a disposition that is certainly within the power of the court.
Why isn't it inappropriate? When you refer in your motions papers, I guess it's in the reply to Newman Green, where the Supreme Court stressed or referred to the authority of the Court of Appeals to dismiss a dispensable non-diverse party as one that should be exercised sparingly. That would seem to me that the adverb sparingly concedes that it should be exercised sometimes. And a case in which you've had as much devotion of judicial resource and litigant resource as this one, if you're ever going to do it, why wouldn't this be the case in which to do it?
I can't disagree with that, Judge Sentell, except to point out that this is Rule 17. And the outcome here is that these parties are in the case as the real parties in interest. And it is not an issue of joinder. It is an issue of Rule 17 ratification.
You're not contending that all of these parties are non-diverse, right?
We don't know.
That's
the problem. We don't know.
Okay, that would seem to be consistent with Judge Williams' original question of why shouldn't we send it back so the district court can find out?
And my response to that is the one I gave, which is with 1,400 parties having previously denied our request for identification of them without knowing who they are.
Well, the request that you have given us this morning is a reference in a telephone conversation, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that is what is in the record on appeal.
That's what we have to go by. And if you had something more than that, I would assume you would tell us that you had something.
Your Honor, I do not have anything more than
that's what I thought. So you really don't have much support for the statement that we made the request and it was refused.
Well, it's admitted in the appellee's brief, so I certainly have that support.
Yeah, it was refused on grounds of timing.
Yeah. Yes, Judge Williams, that is correct. I can't disagree with any of what you're saying. And again, as I said in the brief that we filed, I apologize for raising this issue at this late date. It was simply when I saw 3M in the appendix and recognized that Cambrex, one of the defendants, is a Delaware corporation. It occurred to me that 3M is probably a Delaware corporation as well. I verified that, and that was the result of the timing of this. It was not something that we raised at the last moment strategically. Now, if I could, Your Honors, if I could get to the violation issues, which, you know, if you take the approach that we're seeking, that would moot the Rule 17 issues. If the judgment is reversed outright, then
it doesn't moot it because we can't rule in your favor or against you until we have jurisdiction.
Well, that's a fair point, Judge Williams. You are on the violation issues. I'm going to start with the in-bank decision in Microsoft and the holding of the case that significant foreclosure is an essential element of the plaintiff's proofs in every exclusive dealing case. And our fundamental point is that there is no evidence of substantial foreclosure in this record. And I have 4 points. First, the only competitors affected at all were Watson and PurePak. They were the only ones sourcing API from Proformco. But both Watson and PurePak had ample supply within a few months of the exclusive agreements with Proformco.
Counsel, somehow or other, the API price went up 3,000%, right? I mean,
the tablet price went
up. That's the tablet? Okay, tablet
the
price.
The API prices were all over the map. There was the price from Proformco. There was the high API price from FIS. There was a much lower price from Technochemie. But the tablet prices went up. We can assume that they went up 3,000%. We're not disputing that proposition.
Okay.
But the existence of a price increase, the Supreme Court told us in Legion, and this is consistent with the court's holdings in Discon and in Trinco as well, the Supreme Court said that a price increase resulting from a vertical agreement is not itself sufficient to prove harm to competition. You have to show harm to competition. And in this case, this is an exclusive dealing case, we have to show that there was a significant foreclosure, significant impairment of rivals resulting from the exclusive agreements. Now, there's no question
well,
there
the
was...
the rivals can't get the API at the former price, and there seems to be a logical causal relationship between the exclusive deal and the change in price, why doesn't that get you there, get the plaintiffs there?
All right, Your Honor, I'm going to go back to your decision in the Rambus case, in which Judge Randolph participated as well. And let's go back there. Do we have foreclosure of rivals here, or do we have more efficient exploitation of a pre-existing market power?
What was the purpose of the agreement?
There is evidence that's contested, but for purposes of the appeal, we have to assume that the purpose of the agreement was to foreclose rivals and to increase
and that
prices.
That given that purpose, the existence of the agreement is evidence of foreclosure.
Yeah. No, Your Honor, because Microsoft says, and Judge Easterbrook's decision in the poultry case says as well, that intent by itself is not enough.
Oh, you can't say by itself is not enough.
By itself. I said it's evidence of.
It's not irrelevant, but it's not sufficient.
Intent is not sufficient. Price increases are not sufficient. But that doesn't mean that the totality of evidence that went to the jury here wasn't sufficient. You're not giving us any cases that says these are not relevant. You're just saying that they're not sufficient.
That's not saying.
I used to argue the same thing when I was trying cases that, well, this argument, this item of evidence by itself doesn't prove it, anything, and it often didn't. But when you put it all together, sometimes it did.
Our point is somewhat different here. Our point is that the evidence is not legally sufficient and, as a matter of law, should not have been allowed to go to the jury.
So. Each of those items is not sufficient. The fact that they're not sufficient does not mean that all the evidence taken together is not sufficient.
That's correct, but our position is, and I believe the cases are consistent with our position, the evidence taken as a whole was not sufficient to go to the jury either. Now, I'd like the evidence of that there was no foreclosure here is overwhelming. All right, there was more API supply in the market in 1998 than in 1997. There were more competitors in the market in 1998 than 1997. I want to get back to the point I was making.
I mean, perhaps the contract-driven rise in price brought some more production into the market at that price.
No question about it, Your Honor. But the question is whether.
Well, but if you artificially raise, if you are able, by such an agreement, to artificially raise the price, and that draws new supply into the market. Which for a certain period of time, which is a critical question, keeps the price very high. I don't see why that doesn't amount to foreclosure of the essentially the price and quantity that would have prevailed otherwise.
Your Honor, the question is whether there is sufficient evidence to connect the two. And here we know that price was raised by Mylan to 50% of the brand price, not just on chlorazepate and lorazepam, not just on those drugs, but on 13 different drugs. And on 10 of those, there was no exclusive agreement whatsoever.
Yeah, I saw that argument. I thought it was very interesting. But you never, in your brief, you never followed it up with any detail about these other products.
Well, Your
Honor, your opening brief even gives their names.
The names are in the record. I do not have them handy with me at the podium, but the names are in the record, Your Honor.
I mean, if in fact they follow the same price and quantity pattern as lorazepam, et cetera, then it would seem to me you'd have a very strong point, but you don't call our attention to any evidence that was the case.
Well, Your Honor, I think we do. I think we point to the uncontroverted evidence that all of these drugs were raised to a price level 50% of the branded price. That's right in our briefs, and that there were not exclusives on 10 of the 13 drugs. So given that, and given the absence of foreclosure, remember only one.
Given the absence of foreclosure is a pretty strong given. I mean, we've discussed whether there was evidence sufficient on whether there was foreclosure or not up here. I don't think that's a given, counsel, that there's no evidence of foreclosure.
Fair point. Our argument is that it's clear there was no foreclosure. Obviously, the other side argues the opposite, Judge Sentell. I can't disagree with that. My basic point here is what is undisputed is that quantity went up of API, that the number of rivals increased, attracted by the increased price levels, no question about that. But we also have, we're only dealing here with a single source of supply, ProFarmco, and not even that, because there was available supply from ProFarmco in Europe. PurePak, one of the two foreclosed competitors, in fact, sourced API for lorazepam from ProFarmco in Europe through a distributor by the name of Massai. And when you are dealing with a single API supplier, it is just like Jeddak in Rambus. It is just like New York Telephone in the Discon case. We're not talking about adding any additional market power at the API level. whatever power ProFarmco had was simply exploited more efficiently through these agreements, as in Rambus, as in Discon.
It seems to me the dramatic change in price of the API suggests that supply from one source, to be sure, had been artificially restricted, and therefore other alternative supplies were able to come into the market at very, very high prices.
There was no quantity restriction of API supply from ProFarmco. All of the other API suppliers...
Sorry, there was a quantity restriction. No one could get it from ProFarmco, right?
Well, PurePak did. They got it in Europe. Mylan had it. There were other sources available. There was Technochemie.
Say there are other sources available without regard to price is disregarding the whole problem.
Your Honor, the price increase from the other suppliers is unquestionably attributable to lawful parallel conduct by those suppliers. There is no charge in the case that there was an agreement among rivals at the API level. Whatever market...
It doesn't have to be an agreement because there's been the scarcity artificially created by Mylan ProFarmco in their contract.
Your Honor, my time has expired. I would like to talk about damages, but if I could do so on rebuttal, I would appreciate it.
Well, rather than have you rebut something that may or may not be discussed, I'm going to give you, with leave of my colleagues, about 3 more minutes now. And if Judge Williams has further questions, he can ask them, of course. If not, we'll go to damages.
No, let's go to damages.
Okay, go to damages. You've got 3 more minutes.
Particularly, I think, most interesting part is the period after fourth quarter 2000 and first quarter 2002, depending on which drug you're talking about.
Well, if Your Honor is referring to the chart at page 34 of our brief, I think that is the critical point. There's a fundamental disconnect here between the damages awarded and the effect of the exclusive agreement. Now, you know, you can raise prices in a way that does not violate the antitrust laws, and no one accuses the PBMs or pharmacies of being engaged in any unlawful agreement. This is an indirect purchaser case. Indirect purchaser cases are unknown to the federal system as a result of the Supreme Court's decision in Illinois BRIC. Now, the Supreme Court held in Arc America in 1989 that state laws allowing indirect purchaser cases would not be preempted. But the assumption of the Supreme Court is quite clear from the opinion in that case is that the damages that would be awarded is that portion of the overcharge to the direct purchasers that was passed along to the indirect purchasers. What we have here is fundamentally different. We have 100% of that overcharge, plus the additional overcharge being added on by the PBMs and the pharmacies.
Am I reading that the chart correctly, that what happened is shortly after the agreement was voided, the wholesale price dropped back to its original level, but that the retail price that the pharmacies were charging remained at the level that it had risen to during the term of the agreement?
Actually went up. Those lines are moving in different directions. If you look at
your argument, I mean, I guess, although I don't find it explicit, one of the arguments that I at least get from your brief is that given the fact that your clients dropped the prices back after the agreement was voided, but the prices remain high, makes it impossible for you to mitigate damages in any way, because once you've dropped the wholesale price back, then you have no control over what the pharmacies are charging.
Well, that's absolutely right. Now, let me raise the issue that appellees raise, which is they say, well, we didn't change our AWP, our average wholesale price. But that's an important point of the case, because that's the sole basis for asserting that there is a connection between the PBM and pharmacy prices and the price is being charged by Mylan. But the truth is that plaintiffs did not pay AWP. They paid rates that were individually negotiated between them and each PBM and pharmacy. They say that their expert cured for all this, but their expert clearly did not cure for the upcharges by the PBMs and pharmacies. Quite the opposite. He affirmatively included those in the damages sought to be recovered, and our chart makes that quite clear, because the top line is the damage approach that their expert took. Now, Mylan doesn't set AWP. Independent Services set it. Mylan's prices may affect
My recollection is there's this evidence from a Mylan official talking about setting it.
The evidence from the Mylan official is that Mylan would go to the federal government and eliminate the FUL limits, the federal government applies on this, not on AWP. AWP is something of a suggested retail price that we provide to these independent agencies.
So at least Mylan has a role in the creation of AWP.
Yes, Your Honor.
That'll be the final role, but.
But, and let me make this point, and then I will either respond to questions or stand down. But their expert admitted that even though he didn't know how often Mylan used API at all, it was in any event used less than 10 to 20% of the time.
I'm sorry, AWP.
AWP.
Yeah. You said API.
You see, you have the inherent flaw here that occurs from the use of all these initials and acronyms. You said API when you meant AWP. Now, I would note it would have been helpful if somebody in their glossary had put AWP as one of the things you find in the glossary. API is in there, AWP isn't. Also would help if you'd arrange them in alphabetical order, in the English alphabet instead of whatever the order is. Excuse my interruption. Go ahead.
Your Honor, I confess, errors on that and, many other things in my life. And I do want to just close, if I may, with the point that at Joint Appendix 1415, Dr. Saha admits that AWP, not API, is used a tiny fraction of the time. And he also concedes, this is at 1158 and 1164 to 65. The first one is their other expert, Dr. Stern. The second one is actually both Dr. Stern.
What was the prior site you just
1415.
Gave? And you're citing that for what?
That Dr. Saha could not attest that AWP was used more than 5% of the time in setting the actual price. And it was also conceded at the other pages I gave you, 1158, 1164 through 65, that discounts off AWP vary very widely, even though in those cases where it's used at all.
I'm not sure it's part of your burden, but it might be helpful if you had a theory as to why these prices stayed so high after your price fell.
Yes, I do, Your Honor, and it's this, which is that the plaintiffs here and other payors have arrangements with the PBMs and pharmacies for lots of drugs. These are only two. And so the incentive of the plaintiffs here, and they did nothing to bargain down these particular drug prices. They bargained for the entirety of the price. So the incentives of these plaintiffs to bargain down those prices are diminished. And as a result of that, there's no incentive for the PBMs and pharmacies to reduce their prices as well. But that can't be assigned to Mylan.
Presumably they do have an incentive to keep their overall drug prices down, the prices they're paying. Yeah,
that's not clear either.
Well,
we're talking about insurance companies.
Well, let's assume momentarily that they do.
Yes.
Is your argument then, in effect, that they're not really interested in the distribution of the markdowns drug to drug, as long as overall they're getting what they regard as a suitable collective price.
Your Honor, I think the evidence is consistent with that proposition. The we know, for example, that Massachusetts Blue switched PBMs during the course of the case from one to another, and the result was the reason they did that is that that particular, the one they switched to, was much better focused on reducing the branded pharmaceutical prices. And it's undisputed on the record that the result of that switch was that the price for lorazepam and chlorazepate to Massachusetts Blue went up as a result. Now, Dr. Saha cured for that. He cured for that. He did take account of that in his report, but he didn't take account the
This is an illustration of the trade-off principle?
Yes.
Collective?
Yes, Your Honor.
I see. Okay.
And that's around the same as the citation of the JA that you gave a moment ago, I think.
The testimony about the switch is both in Dr. Saha's testimony that he cured for it, but it's also in the testimony of the first witness in the case, who was Mr. Squara from Blue Cross of Massachusetts. His testimony begins at, I believe it's page 539 of the joint appendix.
If there's not further questions, then we'll let you sit down, and we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much for your time, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the appellee.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Martin Lewick for Plaintiffs Appellees. I will be arguing on behalf of each of the plaintiffs today. I'll address the Court's jurisdictional questions, the market foreclosure and the monopoly effects of the defendant's behavior, and then the damages issue.
Start with jurisdiction.
Well, first of all, I would agree that if the Court believes that there has to be further resolution of issues with respect to jurisdiction, the correct approach to adopt is the one that's laid out in the Newman Green case, which I would also point out has authority based in this circuit's law in relying to some degree on the Long case. And it would be entirely appropriate, should the Court make that decision, to send this back to Judge Hogan for some further determination. But I would like to address the issue of jurisdiction before the Court gets to that conclusion, because I believe a fair reading of 28-1367 and the Exxon case compels that there is a straightforward application of supplemental jurisdiction here. And I would like to begin by talking about...
I question the availability of supplemental jurisdiction to cure a lack of diversity. You have sort of written the statutory and case law requirement of perfect diversity into non-existence. If you say you can have supplemental jurisdiction where the only jurisdiction is diversity, and you can have supplemental jurisdiction over non-diverse parties, haven't you, counsel?
Well, what I'm saying is this, Your Honor.
That wasn't what Exxon dealt with, was it?
Well, in Exxon, the question was there original jurisdiction? And they had both a Rule 20 and a Rule 23 issue before them. Here, there's no question that there was original jurisdiction.
Was the defect in Exxon imperfection of diversity?
Well,
or was it the size of the claim?
The specific holding, I believe, was limited to the jurisdictional amount.
There's
also a lot of language about how how diversity jurisdiction itself is totally different.
Yeah.
Well, there is, Your Honor. However, that discussion...
I really don't know what's left of perfect diversity if you say that you can have supplemental jurisdiction over non-diverse parties.
And the statute itself says that. I mean,
yes.
The statute says it's subject to the law regarding 1332.
I recognize that, but also in Exxon, there were 10,000 service stations that were brought in under Rule 23, and that issue was resolved under the supplemental jurisdiction statute. If we just think about how that was postured in Exxon compared to how it's postured here. They're saying no one knows the identity, and we have to go back and look at the diversity citizenship.
Let me give you a very simple hypothetical. Sure. There's one plaintiff and two defendants, and the plaintiff and defendant one are from different states, but defendant two is from the same state as the plaintiff. Would the court have supplemental jurisdiction over defendant two?
I believe they would if it was a joinder.
Then there's no rule of complete diversity anymore, and that's the point of Exxon.
Exactly. I believe it's measured at the time of the complaint, Your Honor, but I will move on. Let me address the issue of market foreclosure.
Give us just a short burst on remedy on the possible jurisdictional defect, counsel.
Well, I would remedial, if the court is going to send it back, then I would look to the Newman Green case directly at where I believe Judge Randolph was commenting at page 2225, which lays out, you know, precisely in of course, limited circumstances, but where there has been a great deal of judicial resources expended, sending it back. The appellate court can either excise the parties, or it says expressly there.
We can't do that here.
I mean, correct.
Even if we wanted to, do we have a record upon which we could do that in this?
I do not believe that you do. So, yeah, in that event, it is appropriate under Newman Green to send it back to the district court for further proceedings.
Well, we could order you to file the citizenship of all 1,400 of the self-insured, but I don't know that my colleagues or I want to undertake that role.
Good point, Judge Randolph is a master.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
You really want this to stand.
I'll address the issue of the foreclosure, and if the court were to look at the Appley's brief at page 27, there's a chart. I could also give you the appendix site if anyone wants to see it larger. It's at appendix 3564, which is in volume 5. But this chart shows what happened to the reimbursement prices for the two drugs at issue, lorazepam and clarazepate, in late January and February, after the exclusive agreements were entered into in November 14 of 1997. And the argument that there is no market foreclosure as a result of those exclusive agreements presupposes that this rapid and market increase in prices, 20 times, is a coincidence. And I would point to one item of testimony from one of the Mylan executives, Mr. Stupar, who was asked if Mylan tried to raise its prices 20 to 30 times while its competitors had available sources of API, what would the effect be on Mylan? He said they would not be able to sell a single tablet. That's at appendix 791. And so from that backdrop, if we go back to how did this come into being, Mylan had learned through its experience with the drug diphenoxylate that a restriction in supply could allow them to raise prices. There, they were selling the diphenoxylate tablets at, I believe, about $15 a bottle and or per 100, and it went up to $252 when they came back into the market. And they also noted, and this is important for the damages analysis, that their competitors came in, Geneva, and followed suit with the high prices, and that, in the words of Mylan executive Rod Jackson, the prices stayed high for a sustained period of time.
Do we have the time period?
Well, I don't have the time period for diphenoxylate at my fingertips, Your Honor.
It seemed to me, and I can't claim to have read all the reports and testimony on it, but that, I mean, Dr. Saha, for example, relies on one footnote, maybe you can give the page site, to Dennis Carlton. That was a very distinguished economist, but for the proposition that prices sometimes stay high. That seems to me pretty vague for the difference between what Mylan was recovering in the out years as opposed to what your clients were evidently paying.
Well, Dr. Saha testified that the prices went up like a rocket and came down like a feather. And he based...
That's a great metaphor, but it's not exactly evidence.
Well, understood, Your Honor. But he based his...
Jury argument.
Well, it's a jury verdict. And it's entitled to deference. But let me give you some evidence on the AWP issue. Because Mylan did set AWP, and I can give you record sites... for their executive, Krinke, he said that Mylan sets AWP, which directly sets reimbursement costs. That's at volume 2, A1040.
I'm sorry. Oh, A1040.
Correct.
I don't think we need the A.
We also put in testimony from Dr. Stern, who was one of plaintiff's two experts on damages at A1108 through 09 and 1207 through 08, showing Mylan's role in setting the AWP prices. And then Mr. Krinke.
Stern must have been relying on other sources because he was not.
He was. He was relying in part on Krinke's testimony. And Krinke also testified that the AWP is the baseline for reimbursement. And if the court looks in the brief...
It's a very strange picture you paint of a manufacturer simply saying, well, I'd really like to get a lot of money. And then everybody kowtows and pays that amount of money. That's somehow, it's not my understanding. And you don't deny that the market was competitive in these out years.
Well,
obviously it was competitive because the price was driven back down to its original level.
For the net wholesale price that Mylan was charging, that's true. But if we think about the mechanism by which those prices got up there, Mylan shocked the system by the degree of market foreclosure, and I can give the court to cites on this, at least 70% in the lorazepam and 93% in clarazepate. And at the moment these prices went up, the competitors, Watson and PurePak and lorazepam, testified they couldn't get any API.
You're back to foreclosure.
Right, but I'm trying to...
I don't think you're helping us on the sustained level of high prices paid by your clients.
Well, back into the damages.
Right, I'm going to try to get there. Look, Mylan knew that when it achieved those prices, that these pharmacy prices were going... the retail pharmacy prices were going to go up. And they documented that. They had a study done by... Capital Resources, that's at Appendix A3738, where they compared gross profit dollars on the AWP pricing, and they showed that, for example, for a 15 milligram prescription of clarazepate, the price was going to go from 248 to four, or the profit was going to go from 248 to 44. 43.
I'm sorry, you seem to be back to the original upward burst in prices, which...
I'm not, because once they got the prices up there, then they maintained that AWP at those levels, and the pricing was tied to that. And so they got that price up to... they maintained control. They exercised control.
Am I wrong that after the agreement expired, that the wholesale price that Mylan was charging dropped?
You are not wrong. It did.
Okay, it did. And the question I think that's troubling me, I can't speak for my colleagues, but is why the pharmacy price didn't drop after that?
It's because Mylan actually exercised control over that pharmacy price through the average wholesale price. They influenced and set it.
You're depicting a market in which the seller is able to just declare, I'd like to have a monopoly price, and I will ask for it, and I will get it. But that just, in this period after Mylan's own price drops. That cannot be the case.
I don't understand it.
Well, Your Honor, the AWP, you know, the evidence in the record is that those average wholesale prices are set by the manufacturer. And then the PBMs and the pharmacies give discounts off of that, and they enter into contracts with the third-party payors. And the documents that I would like to at least cite to the court that show that that was exactly what Mylan understood was going to happen and told the pharmacies was going to happen, I think makes it foreseeable. So there's causation.
The site at 3738, we'll take us there.
Let me give you several, Your Honor,
okay.
Because I think there are three or four that will help. One is Exhibit PEX1199 at A3738, and I would point the court specifically to A3744 and 45 in addition to the first page of that document. The second is a Mylan document which shows a chart in March of 1998 showing percentage increases of the retail pricing that the third-party payers would pay.
Based on the assumption, though, that the wholesale price will remain at the inflated level that it was during the existence of the agreement, the chart?
I don't think that chart specifically addresses that, but it shows.
The charts that you're talking about were projections done in contemplation of the existence of the agreement.
This one is actually 3 months into the next year, so about 5 months after the agreement.
Right.
And showing.
After the agreement started or after it ended?
After the agreement started, so in that period. And then I would point the court to PEX 230. Which is a letter to pharmacy professionals telling them that your prices are going to go up from us, but you will
be... Is there a joint appendix set for that document?
Yeah. Sorry, Your Honor. A3647.
Can you tell me what, during this period, if we saw these charts and the defendants have their chart, and we talked about that, what's missing from these charts is what was happening after the agreement expired. What did Watson and PurePak do with respect to their wholesale prices?
They came back in, and they came back in at very high prices. And we asserted an umbrella damages theory. Judge Hogan did not allow that theory to go to the jury. I think it makes sense to look at it.
That's even that. I take it would relate to the period before, even if you'd gotten that before the jury, it could only relate to the period before Mylan's wholesale price was back down to the pre-project levels.
I think that's a fair inference, Your Honor. Let me move on to the, if you have any further questions for me on the damages issue, I'll move on to the foreclosure issue if you have any. But I think if we look at the foreclosure itself, which they are asking this court to, as a matter of law, to rule that there has been no market foreclosure, I think if the court looks at the record of what happened immediately after the shock to the system on the prices,
one can probably figure it out from data that I have seen, but I haven't seen. At least I don't recall having seen a specific point in the record that says what at various times the API component was as a fraction of the manufacturer's price for the tablet.
I do not have a component cost on that, but I do have the gross cost and what happened to raising rivals' costs as a result of the conduct. And namely, for lorazepam API, it went from about $500 to $700 per kilogram in 1997 to $15,000 to $150,000 in 1998. And for chlorazepate, it went from about $345 per kilogram to $7,000 to $13,000 per kilogram. And those are for both of them, they are at Appendix 1256. So I think the bottom line on the issue of the foreclosure, you have a situation where Mylan was able to raise the prices more than 20 times, gain market share, and reap enormous profits. And you have under Microsoft, direct evidence of monopoly power. You have in the restraint of trade issue of just looking at the market foreclosure, there are no pro-competitive benefits that have come from this for anyone. I didn't hear any on argument from counsel and haven't seen any in the briefs. All of the impact has been negative to the third-party payors.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We talked Mr. Jacobs from well past his time, but I'll give him back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'm going to go as rapidly as I can. But appendix page 502 is Judge Hogan, quote, "It is undisputed that AWP prices are not set directly by Mylan, but published by independent information services." In fact, Your Honor, I don't think any factual issue here. Mylan recommends AWP, independent agencies set it. You can see that on the very page that the counsel cited to the court, 3738. It said reimbursement based on the AWP using each agency's reimbursement equation. And we still have
the agencies being which, the PBMs or what?
No, independent services that publish the AWP. And what's also undisputed, I didn't hear counsel respond to this, is that AWP has used a tiny fraction of the time, even as a starting point, for negotiations. Now, I do want to get to a point on jurisdiction, and I want to refer your honors to the Eighth Circuit case I mentioned, the Associated case. It's 149 F3rd 794. And the court there explains that a Rule 17 problem is not misjoinder. Under Rule 17, the parties are in the case from the beginning. That's the explicit text of 17A3. So the appropriate remedy, the Eighth Circuit said, in this kind of case is to vacate and remand for dismissal. So that is the result that we're asking for, and you know, Your Honors have pointed out correctly.
Is that consistent with Newman Green?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I believe it is, because this is Rule 17. It's not Rule 20 or Rule 21.
You don't claim that these 1,400 self-insureds are indispensable parties, do you?
No, Your Honor. I mean, they have their own lawsuits. These are separate lawsuits. The other thing is, I misspoke. There are discovery requests, written requests for these names in the record. It's docket 466, 485, and it's in a motion for sanctions that we filed at docket 501 and docket 508. These are not in the joint appendix. They are in the record on appeal. And these were written requests for these names. So
six volumes of joint appendix, they're not in there.
Your Honor, again, you know, this is an issue that just came to me last week when I saw the name 3M reading through the appendix. I can't apologize enough. I wish I had raised this earlier. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Unless my colleagues have further questions, the case is submitted.